2 years ago, President Bush's State of the Union message featured the phrase "axis of evil." He denounced Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as rogue states. Last night, the president took a different tack and focused on Libya's decision to abandon its weapons of mass destruction. As it happens, there is news today about the nuclear programs in both Iran, Libya, and North Korea. We're going to focus for the remainder of this hour on the spread of nuclear weapons. In a few minutes, we'll hear excerpts from testimony earlier today from an American nuclear scientist who describes the plutonium he was shown in North Korea. Former Ambassador Jack Pritchard was on that same trip. He will join us later to take your calls. We'll start, though, with Libya. Is Colonel Gaddafi's decision a success for American policy, and how much of the credit belongs to the president's policies? And with Iran, where new questions are being raised about the genesis and the future of nuclear programs. You're invited to join us. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. With us here in Studio 3A is Joseph Cirincione, a senior associate and director of the Nonproliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of Deadly Arsenals, Tracking Weapons of Mass Destruction. And Joe, good to have you back on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Neil.
Earlier today at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Iranian President Mohammad Khatami told a news conference that Tehran has never sought to acquire weapons of mass destruction. The announcement comes on the heels of this month's news that Iran agreed to open its nuclear facilities to international inspectors. This is nothing new for Iran to deny that it ever had any nuclear intentions. Interesting that he would make this statement so boldly at that particular forum.
Well, this is actually consistent with previous Iranian statements. They have consistently denied that their program is actually geared towards nuclear weapons. And in fact, it's hard to distinguish between the activities designed to produce nuclear fuel, enrich uranium to make fuel to put in a nuclear reactor, and the process that basically just continues that enrichment and turns it into weapons-grade uranium. There aren't many people here in the United States who actually believe Khatami's statement. I think almost everyone believes that the activities that they kept secret for several years were actually designed to have at least a nuclear weapons option.
In response to a question that was apparently shouted at him, he vehemently denied that Iran had ever imported any nuclear material from North Korea.
That we don't know if that's true yet. It appears that Pakistan is the key supplier for both the Iranian centrifuges. These are the machines that spin the uranium and do the actual enrichment, and for the Libyan centrifuges as well. And it's probably Pakistan that sold the centrifuges to North Korea. So Khatami may be correct in his statement that it wasn't North Korea at all. He's just not telling yet exactly who it was.
In recent weeks, though, Iran agreed to, as we mentioned, allow international inspectors, but also agreed to shut down its uranium enrichment program, at least for the time being.
Yes, this is actually the good news, and that's the other part of Khatami's statement when he says we vehemently oppose the manufacture and production of nuclear weapons. We want him to be making that kind of statement. We want to establish that as Iranian national policy. In fact, we'd like to establish that as international policy. This is a norm that we'd all like to see spread. So that's the good part of what Khatami's saying. Currently, there are some questions about how Iran is actually implementing their commitment to suspend the uranium enrichment program. The United States and the European Union foreign ministers who negotiated that deal understood it to mean that they were suspending everything. Iran apparently is interpreting it to mean they're actually just suspending the enrichment of the uranium itself, and they apparently are continuing to assemble the centrifuges and perhaps to engage in some manufacture of centrifuges. That's more than just a semantic difference. We want to see the entire process shut down.
And obviously there is a long background of mutual hostility and suspicion that fuels doubts on both sides.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, clearly since the 1979 revolution, there's been tremendous mistrust on both the United States and the U.S. and the Iranian part. There's a long way to go before we reestablish the kind of trust we had with Iran in the past.
Let's move on to Libya. Last night, President Bush made it clear that he thought his hard-nosed policies in Iraq were the reason that Libya agreed to dismantle its weapons of mass destruction. Now, obviously, this is a long and complicated story. In essence, is the president right?
I don't believe he's right, but it's understandable that he's making that argument. He wants to claim that it's the doctrine of preemption, the fact that we militarily attacked Iraq, that sent a message to Libya that they should get with the program and give up their nuclear and chemical weapons programs.
And the timing is striking. I mean, these negotiations that led to this agreement started as tanks were beginning to roll in Iraq.
Pretty much in March, right before the war, according to the Prime Minister Blair, who announced this jointly with the president about a month ago. But the process really was underway for years before that, and this is a negotiations, a dialogue that spans administrations and spans particular policies. Apparently, Gaddafi was more influenced by economic motives. That is, he wanted to get out from under the sanctions that had been imposed by the U.S. and the United Nations after Libya's downing of a Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. And in the negotiations to do that, it became clear to him that U.S. was concerned about his weapons programs and would only consider lifting the sanctions once he gave up those programs. So he signaled fairly early on that he was intent on doing this, that these programs were of little strategic value to him anymore. He was more interested in contracts than in threats.
Yet it was just a few months ago that a ship bearing apparently gas centrifuges for enrichment of uranium on its way to Libya was intercepted.
Now that's a very interesting story, because at first, this was back in October, that was interpreted as proof that Gaddafi was still intent on pursuing his programs. And this, the interpretation went around this town that it was the U.S. that caught that ship, had the goods, confronted Gaddafi with the goods, and then and only then did he agree to back down his programs. There's now a story coming out, and it was printed this Saturday in The Guardian.
Mm-hmm. And you can, the British newspaper.
The British newspaper, The Guardian, that Gaddafi himself informed the CIA about this shipment and turned it over to the CIA as evidence of his good faith in this negotiation. That he was saying, basically, look, I'm coming clean. I don't need any of this stuff. I don't want this stuff. Here it is. And by the way, here's the list of suppliers that I'm buying it from. This is like a drug dealer now caught on the street that's rolling over on his suppliers. And he's giving us a lot of information about where he got this material from, where he got these centrifuges, who built them. And that's helping us track down and perhaps crack open the whole international supply network. So this is an extremely significant development.
And by way of mention, you mentioned Pakistan's role or possible role in proliferating perhaps to Iran, perhaps to North Korea, and perhaps to Libya. A large group of Pakistani nuclear scientists is now being held, some under house arrest and some apparently in police custody.
Well, this is a little like closing the barn door, after the horse is gone. It's good that Pakistan has taken this step and stopping its nuclear scientists from traveling abroad. But there's a great deal of evidence that indicates that Pakistan, particularly this guy, Dr. Khan, mm-hmm. A.Q. Khan, that we've talked about previously on this program, was responsible for giving centrifuges to first North Korea and then to Iran about 15 or 16 years ago, and now apparently to Libya. There's new evidence coming to light that some of these centrifuges may be manufactured in Malaysia, which is one of the reasons Undersecretary of State John Bolton is in Malaysia this week, trying to get to the bottom of this. So while we've been looking at these sort of axis of evil countries, it turns out that some of our allies are actually the enablers of these programs, and a lot more has to be done with our allies to crack down on the supply of both of these materials that could enable another country to actually build a nuclear weapon.
Before we leave Libya, though, a bipartisan group of American lawmakers said today that they're preparing to travel to Libya this weekend to meet with Colonel Gaddafi. Nothing like this has happened since he took power back there in 1969 and kicked the Americans out of their base at Wheelis Air Force Base.
You know, I don't think it's sunk in yet just what a dramatic transformation this is. I mean, Colonel Gaddafi has traded in his Arab nationalist headgear for a business suit. He wants to do business. He's in trouble. His economy is in trouble. He wants to get out from under the sanctions. There is significant Islamic fundamentalist opposition to him in his country. Remember, Gaddafi's a secular leader. Mm-hmm. He is not an Islamic fundamentalist. He's the opponent of al-Qaeda-type organizations. And now he's welcoming a Republican-led congressional delegation led by a Kurt Weldon, who is one of the leaders in the House of Representatives on these nonproliferation issues, and they're going to explore further Gaddafi's pledge and to just, you know, sort of meet him face to face and encourage this process along. As far as we can tell, what's going on in Libya right now is there are U.S. and British experts there. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is also involved, and they're working out the logistics. They're literally deciding who should do what, how should we move this stuff. But we're all talking about moving all this equipment, all these materials out of Libya and disassembling it, shutting down those programs for good, and then establishing a verification mechanism to make sure they stay shut down.
Now we're going to spend the rest of the program talking about North Korea. And today on Capitol Hill, the second day of testimony from Siegfried Hecker, the former director of the Los Alamos Nuclear Research Laboratory. He was on a trip earlier this month to visit North Korea's main nuclear complex at Yongbyon. We'll be hearing from another member of that delegation a little bit later in the program who will be able to take our calls on exactly what he saw and what North Korea is like these days. But first, we wanted to hear some of what Mr. Hecker had to say. And this is his inspection with the other members of the visit. It wasn't really an inspection, but their visit to the storage pool where they saw the place where the plutonium rods that were produced by North Korea's one operating nuclear reactor, where those rods had been stored since 1994 in association with a deal, an agreement reached with the United States.
So that was the key issue. What happened to those fuel rods? So now I'll get to the answer. So we walked in with appropriate protective clothing. The chief engineer took us up to the observation platform. We looked into the pool. First thing is that none of the structure that had been built, so-called poles and lockdown plates, for the verification was there anymore. That was gone, not in sight. Second is when we looked into the pool, there was a metal grid to separate these, I should have said, the U.S. canisters. There were 20 fuel rods in each stainless steel canister, somewhere over half a meter long and about 10 to 12 inches in diameter or so. They were stacked in too high into this grid so that they would be nicely separated down deep in the pool being from what I've read, somewhere between 5 and 7 meters, so over 20 feet deep. We looked in, and many of the gridded areas were empty. There were no canisters, and once upon a time, they were all full. Some of the canisters had the lids off, and there didn't seem to be anything in there. And some of them were still there closed. So our host showed us this, took us back out in the conference room, and said, okay, look, the fuel rods are gone. And, you know, in typical scientific fashion, I said, well, some of them appear to be gone, but how can I tell that they're all gone? And so they thought for a while and said, well, suppose you go back in and you pick one at random that's closed and we'll open it for you. I said, that's a pretty good test. So we went back in, they did all the operations, picked up this canister, left it in the water, moved it to a workstation, opened it up, brought the light over, I looked in and there were no fuel rods. I also had a chance to look around the back. There was a back side of the pool. But all of the observations then were consistent with the fact that the fuel rods are gone.
That is Siegfried Hecker, the former director of the Los Alamos National Lab, speaking before the U.S. Senate committee earlier today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joseph Cirincione is still with us here in Studio 3A. And as we listen to this testimony by Mr. Hecker, I guess we've got to go back into remind people what the two sources of nuclear weapons material are. He's talking about plutonium rods. These are the byproducts of the of nuclear reactors of the sort that were built in North Korea, that reactor originally built by the Soviet Union.
Right. There's two ways to make a nuclear bomb, two materials that you use. The first we just talked about with Iran. You take natural uranium out of the ground and you enrich it until you have the right concentration of the isotope U-235, and you use the uranium to make a bomb. The other is that you take these uranium fuel rods, and that's what we're talking about here, that have been run through a reactor, that have gone through fission, slow fission, controlled fission, and in that process, some of the uranium is converted over to plutonium, various isotopes of plutonium. And what the North Koreans, like many other people, can do is then take those fuel rods, reprocess them, filter out the plutonium, get that plutonium, form it into a metal softball, and that's your plutonium bomb.
The United States has been somewhat skeptical that, in fact, North Korea has gone ahead with the nuclear reprocessing of those plutonium fuel rods. The North Koreans said they had, and here's Mr. Hecker detailing his experience examining what the North Koreans claimed was actual processed plutonium.
When I expressed my skepticism, they said, well, would you like to see the product? And I was sort of taken aback, and I said, well, yes, you know, if you have the product to show, that would be one step closer. So we're in a conference room, and they brought in a red metal box, opened that up, and inside was a white wooden box with a slide-off top. They opened that up, and the inside were two glass jars, sort of like jelly jars, with a screw-on lid, tightly taped. And they said, this first one has 150 grams of oxalate, plutonium oxalate powder. And it was a greenish powder. The second jar, they said, well, that's the product. That's plutonium metal in this jar. And they said, it's 200 grams of plutonium metal. So kind of a fifth of a kilogram or something, you know, close to half a pound. So reasonably substantial. Now, plutonium is very dense. You know, if you think lead is heavy or dense, plutonium is sort of 50% heavier than lead, depending on what particular form of plutonium you have. So they covered that back up. Along the way, they told us a little bit about the plutonium, I think trying to impress us that it was plutonium, because I asked what the density was. They told me between 15 and 16 grams per cubic centimeter. That's something that I do know something about. And so I raised my eyebrows, because to me that tells me right away what phase the plutonium is in. And the director added right away, it's alloy. So they had all of that right, took it back out and said, okay, now we've demonstrated, you know, our plutonium. And they often like to say our deterrent. And I said, well, you know, actually, I looked at it very closely and, you know, it looked like it could be plutonium. I looked at the metal. It was a peculiar shape that I, to this day, have not figured out why, and that is a funnel shape, thin-walled, and I described the dimensions in my testimony. And I looked at the surface of that, and it was consistent with plutonium that had been cast recently. And they actually told me, they said, this plutonium was cast from our most recent campaign, and it's the scrap piece from a casting. And the surface of the plutonium was sort of dark gray, blackish, rough surface, because it, they said, from a casting, which typically means that one uses graphite molds.
When we come back from a short break, we're going to hear the remainder of the story from Siegfried Hecker as he examines what purports to be plutonium metal shown him by the North Koreans. We're also going to hear from Ambassador Jack Pritchard, who was with him on that visit to North Korea, about what he saw and about the message he thinks the North Koreans were trying to send. And we have at this point to thank Joseph Cirincione for being with us here in Studio 3A. As always, a pleasure to have you in to talk about proliferation programs elsewhere around the world. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
So if you'd like to join our conversation about North Korea, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN, at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we are talking about proliferation, and before we continue, we want to hear the last cut that we're going to hear in the testimony from earlier in the day by Siegfried Hecker, formerly the director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, who describing his visit to North Korean nuclear facilities. And here he talks about how he tried to verify that what the North Koreans were showing him in that glass bottle was indeed plutonium.
So they brought the plutonium back in. I said, I don't want the powder, but I'll take a look at the metal. And so I held the metal jar with this, you know, presumed plutonium inside to take a closer look. And the first comment I made was, you know, it's not very warm, but it was warm. And the director said right away, well, that's because the 240 isotopic content of the plutonium, one of the many isotopes of plutonium that gets grown into the reactor, as well as the high-octane 239 plutonium that one uses either for a reactor performance or for bombs, that tends to warm up the plutonium more. And he said, its low 240 content, which also turns out to be the lower the 240, the better weapons grade it makes for the plutonium. And I asked him what 240 content, and he says, well, I can't tell you that, but you can ask the IAEA. Then the second thing, in terms of the weight, it seemed about right. And then we had one more test when we finished. I put it back. I said, I'd like to get my gloves monitored, to make sure I didn't pick up any contamination. They brought a radiation detector, and from everything I can tell, I didn't get a really close look, but it was a Geiger counter. As soon as the technician turned that on, the Geiger counter went off, and it would pick up the weak gamma rays from the plutonium. He said right away, take this plutonium away from here. They did. The detector settled down. They monitored my hands, and they found nothing. It's not the greatest way to monitor for contamination, but it's a way.
Jack Pritchard joins us now. He was one of the people who visited the North Korean nuclear facilities with Siegfried Hecker. Until last summer, Jack Pritchard served as President Bush's special envoy to North Korea. He is now a visiting fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. He joins us from their studios here in Washington. And good to have you back, Ambassador Pritchard.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
When you were you in the room when those bottles of plutonium were shown to Siegfried Hecker?
We were. Sig initially told us that we could leave the room as he further examined that. But I think we all had an insatiable curiosity to be there. He explained to us that it was probably very safe, and we took his word, but we were there. We witnessed all that you've just listened to.
Probably very safe. That's not very reassuring. Yeah. Clearly, that, though, was a critical moment in your trip. The North Koreans were clearly trying to send a message.
They were. They have all along tried in their minds to be very transparent, having told me when I was in the Bush administration in advance each step of the way what they intended to do, and then reporting to me and through me to the administration that they had completed that. They were received with some degree of skepticism, so I think part of this trip was designed to have another in essence, a third party look at what they had in report, and as Dr. Hecker has now done.
And clearly, this was not a government delegation, though they knew that you were going there and would be reporting back to the government.
Yes, that's precisely. There was no no confusion on anybody's part, neither our government nor the North Koreans. They all knew that we were going as private citizens. But, of course, we would report back and tell our government precisely what we saw.
Now, presumably, the North Koreans, there's a long involved diplomatic dance going on in terms of what kinds of negotiations are being conducted and when. But the North Koreans are trying to signal that they want that they've got what they would describe as a nuclear deterrent.
They've been saying that for some time now, over the last several months of this past year. Part of that is, as they've watched the developments in Iraq, they wanted to set aside the possibility that the United States would take preemptive action against them. So now, having done that, they're signaling, we're prepared to talk to you. It's a serious issue. We've shown you what we have. Let's sit down and talk.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. And let's get a question in from Sarah, who's with us in Alexandria, Virginia. Sarah, you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. I have a question for you. Given how much the North
Koreans... Sarah apparently reached the end of her cell phone battery's life. We have reason to believe that the question she wanted to ask is how much of this is saber-rattling? How serious are they?
Well, in my opinion, there's an element of saber-rattling that's all part of posturing for negotiations. But they are very serious in terms of if this can't be resolved diplomatically, they're prepared just to walk away, declare their deterrent capability, and hope for the best in developing relationships with others in the region. But it is not intended, from their point of view, to be offensive or threatening, although from a nonproliferation point of view, we can't accept that on face value.
Now, in his testimony before the Senate committee earlier today, Siegfried Hecker, of former director of Los Alamos, said, yes, we did see what looked like plutonium, but he says he's not sure that they could actually weaponize it, in other words, make a bomb that would be small enough to work and actually fit in a missile nose cone.
Right. Well, let's go back to what the CIA in open testimony has told our Congress and our public, and that is they firmly believe that North Korea has one or two, in some estimates are a little higher, nuclear weapons from 10-plus years ago, and they believe that North Korea has the capability of building a bomb without conducting a test. So if you believe that as a base, then there's no reason not to believe they currently have the capability and could move towards a weaponization as they claim they have the capability to do.
Now, the North Koreans, as recently as a couple of months ago, agreed to freeze the facility that the nuclear reactor that develops the plutonium, the kind of plutonium that they would have shown you and Siegfried Hecker and the other members of the trip, and that they would offer to do that, off the bat. But the United States is convinced that there is indeed another North Korean nuclear weapons development program that involves highly enriched uranium, and This is a major point.
Well, it is a major point, but let's break it down into its component pieces. First of all, the plutonium that Dr. Hecker was talking about is a problem now. The HEU is a problem later. So our security threat from North Korea comes from freezing, in my opinion, the facilities at Yongbyon and getting control of the current threat.
Yongbyon is where the nuclear reactor is.
Yeah, that's correct.
And the reprocessing facility, yes.
It is all there. That's where we visited.
Yet the North Koreans at one point, and I believe you were there under those circumstances too, admitted that they had an HEU program, highly enriched uranium, and now they're denying that.
That's correct. That occurred on the 4th of October in 2002. A small U.S. delegation went to Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, confronting the North Koreans on our intelligence information that they possessed an HEU, highly enriched uranium, program. We certainly believed that we heard an admission of that. I don't step back from what I heard then. But quite frankly, I believe it's immaterial whether they agreed that they had it or disagreed, and they now are denying it. The U.S. policy reaction to this is based or should be based on the intelligence information, not their admission.
And you, in an op-ed piece published today in the New York Times, suggested that U.S. intelligence in this arena has been, I think your word was, amateurish.
No, that was my word for the policy. But failure was the word that I used for U.S. intelligence over the long term on North Korea.
And that because there have been mistakes before where apparently American intelligence agencies cried wolf?
Precisely. The one that comes to mind that is most recent is the U.S. intelligence community adamantly insisting that North Korea was trying to duplicate underground the facilities that we just saw at Yongbyon. That turned out to be absolutely not the case. The difference in this particular case, just to be clear, while I was skeptical 5 years ago in the summer of 1998 over the U.S. intelligence, I am not skeptical. While I can't go into it, my belief is based upon what appears to be a unanimous version view within the U.S. intelligence community to include people that I have a high degree of respect that are normally very skeptical in these kind of situations, but they all believe that the North Koreans do possess an HEU program.
We're speaking with Ambassador Jack Pritchard, a member of the U.S. delegation that recently returned from North Korea, now a visiting fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a listener on the line. This is John, who's with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hello, Ambassador Pritchard. I would like to get your opinion on what the Chinese interlocutors that you met with in Beijing, following your visit to Pyongyang, what their comments were in reaction to what you and Dr. Hecker, as well as Dr. Lewis, saw in Yongbyon?
Yeah. Well, part of the problem that coming out of Pyongyang and going into Beijing, we had not yet had an opportunity to report back to the various U.S. government agencies that we needed to. We had congressional aides there. We had Dr. Hecker and others. So it was inappropriate for us to first tell the Chinese what we saw. So we really did not. We have subsequently had conversations. I today had some conversations with Chinese diplomats. But the problem all along starting with the HEU portion of this, has been skepticism by our friends and allies that the North Koreans are really embarked on this kind of situation. So the more clarity that we can bring to this, the better it is for the development of U.S. policy and working with our allies.
Great. Thanks for the question, John.
Thank you.
In your op-ed in the New York Times, you say that what you're concerned about is that the next round of six-party talks will fail and Pyongyang will withdraw from the diplomatic process. It may then declare that it has developed all the nuclear weapons it needs and it does not intend to make any more. That would leave an awkward situation.
Indeed. This past October, I had an opportunity to talk to a senior North Korean diplomat in Europe. And what he said to me then was, you know, we're really not interested in a continuous cycle of making nuclear weapons. What we need is just a certain level that creates a deterrent capability. And then once we reach that, then that's about all we need. Now, combine that with the prospects of a failed next round of six-party talks, and my fear is exactly that, that the North Koreans will create a de facto situation of a nuclearized Korean peninsula, and those around them may very well accept it.
Well, as South Koreans have been quick to point out, North Korea does not need nuclear weapons to have a deterrence against South Korea. They can do that with their artillery tubes pointed at the capital city of Seoul. So against whom would this deterrence be directed? Presumably the United States. But also, how would South Korea, Japan, and perhaps even Taiwan react to this?
Well, if you're asking the long-range question, if the North Koreans are left to maintain a long-term nuclear capability, would South Korea or Japan or perhaps even Taiwan turn nuclear? I tend to doubt that. However, the Chinese do have concerns about the long-term prospects that Japan may develop nuclear weapons if, in fact, North Korea is left unchecked with their development of their program.
So to reverse what you've described as an amateurish policy, what should the Bush administration do in your regard?
Well, first and foremost, there has to be a single, united, agreed-upon policy that ought to be articulated by the president, what his long-term vision is for the relationship on the peninsula. Then there needs to be, in my opinion, a coordinator, a policy coordinator with sufficient stature and integrity, as I point out in my op-ed today, of Bill Perry, as he did when he was appointed by President Clinton. But this needs to be brought together so that the implementation phase of objectives that the president sets forward can be put together without the infighting that we've seen over the last 3 years.
On your trip, one of the North Korean officials with whom you met said, "Time is not on the United States side." Very quickly, do you agree with him?
No, I do. The problem is that if we accept the probability of what we have seen on this last trip, that the North Koreans have the capability to create plutonium metal and perhaps take the next step to make bombs, time certainly is not on our side. Why in the world would we accept a nuclear North Korea that has been standing up and telling us all along, here are the steps that we're taking, please stop us, and we have not done that.
Jack Pritchard, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Jack Pritchard was a member of the U.S. delegation that recently returned from North Korea, former special envoy to North Korea under President Bush, and now a visiting fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. We spoke to him from the Brookings Institution studios here in Washington, D.C. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.